This is Amanda Beland. I'm the senior producer for Radio Boston. Thanks for listening. You can always check us out online at WBUR.org or on the WBUR app. If you're craving more human-to-human interaction, though, you should join our text club. To get started, text Boston to 617-766-0382.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. So whenever I do a public book event, I am always struck by how many people come, not because they want to ask the author about the book, but because they want to ask about the author's writing process. Good writing's really hard, and good writers have to embrace their own unique needs and their quirks when they do it. And that is part of the philosophy at Grub Street, which is the largest creative writing center in the country, and it's located right here in Boston. And the Grub Street philosophy seems to be working. They say that over the last 5 years, their writing community has published nearly 2,000 novels, essays, memoirs, poems, and of those, close to 200 have been nominated for or honored with awards. Eve Bridberg founded Grub Street. She's the executive director, and we wanted to know how they have kept it all going and growing over the last three decades. So we sat down with Eve last week, and she started with Grub Street's origin story.
I came here to BU, actually, to go to their graduate writing program in fiction. I was young. I was less, I think, committed and serious about writing than a lot of my peers. I came to it later in my development. And the first sign of things being a little bit not what I expected was a note from the director of the program. And it was the rules. And it was just no after no after no. No.
You mean don't do this?
Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't write about emotion, interior life. Don't write like Virginia Woolf. And I didn't have the language for it as a younger person, but it was very sort of male Western canon. There's one way to write this, and we don't quite trust you to do anything different. I mean, one of the no's was don't attempt satire because you won't be able to pull it off. So there was just this, a lot of judgment, a lot of constraints, and a sort of singular vision for how to do things, which I think at the time was very, very common in MFA programs. And for some people, for some writers, it was incredibly effective, and the pieces of it that felt like there was this kind of atmosphere where humiliation and being pushed down were sort of part of it. And then you fought back and you fought for your writing, and that's how you persevered. And that was, you were sort of paying your dues. Well, for me, as someone who was really new to this and not fully formed or even half formed, it was impossible for me to feel like I could create anything in that environment. And it was a very difficult year. But I made some very close friends, and I also got to teach, and I loved teaching. I had a wonderful time teaching. So when it ended, I convinced one of my friends in the program, who's still a dear, dear friend of mine, to teach writing workshops with me in the community to try and create some sort of a community where I could continue to explore and figure out for myself whether this was something I wanted to do. The only thing we really knew, and this is as far as my vision stretched at that point, was that we wanted to bring some of the rigor of honest critical feedback, but do it in a supportive, cheerleading, and positive environment so that people felt that they could take risks and be vulnerable.
You set out to do what somebody didn't do for you.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
Okay. And the biggest difference between what teachers did for you in your year and what you did and or do now for students of writing is X.
Well, at the time, because it's changed, the way we teach has very much evolved over 27 years. You know, you have to remember the world in the mid-90s, Jeff Bezos was just starting to sell books out of his garage. Institutions held all of the gatekeeping power. There were massive gates to the publishing world. You had to get into a prestigious writing program to be able to study writing more seriously. Even the clubs in Boston that were formed around writing, like Penn New England, you had to be a published author to be involved in. So one of the things we did is we just invited anybody with an interest in writing to come to the table and be taken seriously. We're non-paternalistic. We encourage people to define for themselves what they want to do with their writing, and that's where we meet them. We push them to be the best versions of themselves, and we try and create the conditions where all writers of all backgrounds can thrive, and that's where we've done a lot of change over the years.
Are you any good at satire?
Personally, no.
So maybe that one wasn't so far off. That one was okay.
But giving people permission, I think, to take themselves seriously, to not worry about achieving some entry, being able to tell themselves, I'm interested in exploring my imagination. I'm interested in telling this story. I can do it. And someone's going to take me seriously. And I'm going to develop that. And the model has been wildly successful. You know, having a more open, less gated approach. You know, in the last 3 years, we've had 185 books, 1,300 publications out of our programs.
We're here with Eve Bridberg, who is the founder and executive director of Grub Street. So, you know, you talk about all the massive talent here. Is there something in the water here? Or if Grub Street were in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Savannah, Georgia, would you find the same thing?
Yes. I believe that everyone can write. Certainly, talent is a big part of it, and some people are extraordinary writers. But I think most writers would tell you 99% of it is having your butt in the chair and getting the work done, and then being able to take in critical feedback and pushing yourself and working really, really hard. You have to have both of those things. And I think that a lot of people, a lot of stories that should be told and should be out there don't get told because people don't feel like they have the ability to do it when they actually do. And right now we're more, you know, we're a national organization, you know, post-pandemic. We're teaching in every single state in the country except South Dakota. We're also teaching globally. And it's really wonderful to see people come in with an idea and discover what they're capable of.
Did you have any idea you were capable of this?
No.
Of Grub Street?
No.
Do you still surprise yourself sometimes?
Sometimes I have to pinch myself. And I mean, I do want to say, you know, this has truly been a collaborative community project, a sort of social enterprise. And there have been so many hands in this organization over its 27 years.
I want to go back. If 99% of the work in writing is keeping your butt in the chair, what helps you keep your butt in the chair?
I think what keeps my butt in the chair is the social value of what I see that we're accomplishing, which is trying to democratize the publishing landscape, trying to put more representative stories, essays, poems, perspectives out into the world. That, I think, is crucial to our democracy. And then the other thing that keeps me in the chair is what happens in the classroom, and this is challenging in this moment we're in, the idea of really building trust across difference and people sitting with discomfort and perspectives that are challenging and respecting one another in a classroom.
How are you able to create that space when so much of our country and so many of our communities seem to not be able to do that anymore?
That's a great question. First of all, writing. I mean, what good writing asks of you is to look at all the angles, to get your thinking straight, to be really clear, to reach for nuance and depth and understanding and empathy, right? Because if you want to describe something well, you have to understand it, and you have to understand the motivations of the people in the scene, if you will. And then we've worked really hard over years to set the table in our classrooms for creating conditions of belonging. And we're very clear about not guaranteeing safety for anyone, but we try and create brave spaces where people get to tell their stories on their own terms. We ask everyone to come with a sense of cultural humility and a willingness to learn and to grow. Next to that, we have zero tolerance for racism, sexism, homophobia, and bullying behavior or harassment of any kind. So that's a line that we have to, you know, constantly walk. But it's amazing how often it works. It works most of the time.
I'm thinking about you saying that last part in the context of the fact that the film American Fiction was just one of the darlings of the Oscars. And I'll say that as a nominee. It was not a darling in the winner's circle that went to Oppenheimer. But it was a darling of the Oscars as a nominee. It is about a writer in Boston, a black man who writes books that are not about blackness.
Yes.
Cannot get well published until he writes a book that he believes satirically is what white people want to read about blackness. And the white publishing industry eats it up. And he's so offended that he doubles down and the white publishing industry eats more of it.
Yes.
To grossly oversimplify. How much is that reflective of white Boston literary community? And I'm asking you as a white woman who runs a prestigious writing collective in Boston.
Yes. No, fair, totally fair question. And I loved that movie. The publishing industry is still very white, very upper middle class. The needle is moving really slowly. Although I will say in the last several years, they've put a lot of wonderful women of color in publishing positions. And you can see that change is happening, but it's been very, very slow and frustrating. We have been ourselves advocating through our national conference every year, the Muse and the Marketplace, for a more representative publishing industry from top to bottom. We also have been around 2010, I started going to self-publishing conferences to sort of see what was going on and to see what Grub Street might do. At the time, I was working as a literary agent. And one of the biggest takeaways for me during that period was seeing the self-publishing conferences I went to were incredibly diverse, as distinct from Grub Street itself, mainstream publishing spaces that I had been in. I had a really wonderful biracial author who just published a fabulous book last year, Laura Worrell, who said to me, you know, Eve, honestly, Grub Street is known as a place for white writers.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did that feel? How did that feel?
That didn't feel good,
okay.
But it was accurate and fair, and I also had to take it in. So those two experiences led me on a journey where we really prioritized becoming a more inclusive organization. Mm-hmm. We didn't move the needle very much for the first few years, so we really needed to change our financial model and change the way we did basically everything. At first, it was about representation, but it's touched every single aspect of our work.
How have you seen the results? How can you tell it's worked?
Well, we are very much a work in progress, but we are a diverse organization from top to bottom now. We have a large community of writers and of color who come through our doors, a lot of teachers of color who are on our faculty, staffers, board members, and we have a lot of publications.
So we're here with Eve Bridberg, who is founder and executive director of Grub Street, which is the largest creative writing center in the country. I want to look back for a minute, but I don't want to rehash back. I actually want to use it as a way to look forward. All right, so Grub Street had a scandal in the teens that somebody wrote a story about in 2021 and it sort of blew up, right? So I'm going to oversimplify the story. Two people associated with Grub Street. One has a personal situation and posts a letter in a private Facebook group associated with that personal situation. Somebody else associated with Grub Street writes a short story that looks a whole lot like the other person's personal situation. And there is a letter in the short story that has language in it that is very similar to the letter posted in the private Facebook group. There's a lawsuit. Somebody writes about it in 2021. It goes viral, and it just goes viral. Here is why I want to ask about it. I want to ask about it in the context of training writers in a world of artificial intelligence, where a letter like that could get scraped, right, for content and show up anywhere, where AI will take stories from lots of different places and invent new things and is not beholden to give credit to anyone. How do you think about training writers and preparing them in a world where something that intimate blew up that badly and now you have a non-human actor that could conceivably scrape any of that? And I'm sure there's somebody out there saying, no, it can't scrape something from a private Facebook page. Fine. You get my point.
Yes. This is a really good question, and we are tackling it the way we tackle most things, which is we try and have community conversations. So actually coming up on April 17th, we're hosting a really important conversation that's free and open to the public, and it is about AI and exploring what it means, what the impact is on writers, how writers can use it if they want to use it, what the dangers might be. It's a very difficult topic.
On balance, do you think there is more potential for it to harm the future of writers and the world of writing, or do you think there is more potential for it to become a tool that enhances life for writers in the world of writing, or is it too soon to say?
I think it's too soon to say, but I hope it will become a tool that enhances. And I hope, I really applaud the creatives and the artists and the comedians who are going after the companies right now to protect IP rights. I feel like I'm sure we all, from a writing perspective, wish we could redo the early days of the internet because so much content was given away for free and continues to be given away for free. So I hope that we can establish quickly some tools around how to track people's IP so that artists are being paid and they're being attributed for their work and their creativity.
10 years from now, you look back on this most recent decade of Grub Street, and the dream has come true because
there are more and more books and perspectives getting out into the world, and our classes are measurably more diverse than they are today. And we want to, for the city of Boston, be radically accessible. We want to be the place where teens, any teen, can come and take a writing class with zero barriers. We're very close to being there. I think 85% of our programs for high school students are fully funded. And we want to have a stage that's known as a place where we can take on really tough topics with a lot of nuance and depth.
Eve Brinberg, founder and executive director of Grub Street, stopped by Studio 2 last week. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.